Well, folks, I am now going to segue into the second hour of our show, and I just want you to ask me anything. I have a bunch of questions that have come in, and I hope a bunch more will come in. First question that pops up, Gadius Maximus. Gadius, thank you. You're a tireless supporter. You're a great moderator. I really appreciate it. And I like your commentary, too. I very much enjoy it. What do you make of Elon buying part of Twitter? Does this mean our guys will finally be able to get back into BTFOing journals all day and all of the banned MAGA Q crowd will once and for all be able to prove that libtards are the real racists? Well, I hope that better memes are circulated than that on Twitter, obviously, but I'm hopeful. There's no reason to, you know, wrinkle our noses and come up with some kind of negative take on this because, well, we're jaded and self-indulgent and want to make other people enjoy our misery. I don't see any reason to pick holes in this, frankly. I think it's a wonderful opportunity. May turn out great. We'll know he's serious if Trump gets his Twitter back. That would be a political earthquake. I know Trump didn't say a lot that was great on Twitter, but a lot of it was very entertaining. But again, it's not so much what Trump did, it's the metapolitical effect that he has and the fact that he triggers these people. I know there's more that can be done than triggering. Obviously, we want a wall. We want our country back. But it sure helps and it's sure entertaining. I would love it if Trump came back. If Trump came back on Twitter, then I would be very, very happy. I'd buy a Tesla if I could afford it. But I would. I would be Elon Musk's biggest fan if Trump got back on Twitter. And who knows, even maybe I could get back on Twitter. That would be very, very interesting. I wouldn't mind getting my Twitter account back. I had some good tweets that were underrated, I thought. And if they could be resurrected from the ether, I wonder if they save all these accounts that they delete, they ban. I don't know. Probably not. It would be absolutely criminal from a historical point of view if Trump's tweets were deleted by Twitter. Just think about that. Trump was president of the United States. Every jot and tittle and scrap of paper that Trump had on his desk is the kind of stuff that goes into a presidential library. It's the kind of stuff that history is made of. Trump's tweets are history. And if they deleted those when they banned his account, that is equivalent to, well, it's in the same spirit as burning down the Library of Alexandria. Not quite as momentous, perhaps, but it's the same spirit that is present there. And it really shows you what disgusting people libtards are when you put it in that perspective. So that's a good question. My answer is that I'm hopeful. It could be a great thing. I like Elon Musk. I think Elon Musk is an interesting character. And if the richest man in the world is helping us out, that bodes well. So Jasper writes in, Jasper sent in $25. It's very generous and very kind. And I have some other questions from you that I missed in a previous stream. So I'll get to those as well. Jasper writes, I recently listened to an interview with Paul Gottfried in which he ascribed the motivations of neoconservatives to Jewish emotional insecurity. To hear him say this publicly was pleasantly surprising. What is your opinion of Paul Gottfried and his work? Would he make it into countercurrents as memorials of thinkers on the right? Well, I've met Paul Gottfried a couple of times. I've had him autograph his books for me. And the reason why I did that is because I read his books. I've read a lot of his books. I first read Paul Gottfried when I was in graduate school. And I always found his work useful. The first book I read by him was, and I'm actually forgetting the name now, which it's embarrassing. Basically, it's on Hegel's influence on American conservative thinkers, which was an area that was quite interesting to me at the time. It was unfamiliar territory. I think it was called something like The Search for Historical Meaning or something like that. I read his book After Liberalism that was published by Princeton. I read that in the 90s. I thought that was an immensely useful book. His book on multiculturalism and the politics of guilt, I think that's the title, was very, very illuminating to me as well. His book on Marxism and sort of its strange afterlife after the collapse of communism, its various mutated forms, also very useful. I'm trying to think of his other books. He wrote a very good book on fascism. I got him to sign that. I saw him speak about that in New York City when I was living in New York. I thought there was some very interesting work in there. So I'm very, very impressed with Paul Gottfried, and I've learned a lot from him. There's no question about it. Paul Gottfried has also been great at coining terms. He coined the term paleoconservatism. He coined the term alternative right. Those are useful coinages. There's no question about it. So yeah, I think he's an interesting commentator. Oh, I wrote an extensive review of his critique of Leo Strauss. I thought that was a very interesting book, thought-provoking. I like Strauss more than he does, but it was a very well written and very well argued and slim book that zeroes in on a lot of the problems of the Straussians. That was a great service. So yeah, he's an important thinker on the right. I follow his work to this day. And yeah, maybe someday we'll memorialize him, but I hope no time soon, because I hope he's with us for a long time to come. So Niels writes in, he has sent $150. That's fabulous. I really appreciate that. He writes, I just realized that I had forgotten to send a donation for March. So I sent here the donation for both March and April, and with a bit added to the sum as a way of compensation for my forgetfulness. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. As always, the donation is given in the name of the great god Yngwie Fryer. And since it is his favorite season, another bit is added to the sum too. Well, 150 is very, very generous. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. I'm going to go back and find a couple of questions from Jasper that I overlooked. Okay. He gives $50. Most of our discussions focus on how to reverse the decline of whites in our homelands. Immigration moratorium, deportation, and pronatalist policies are certainly crucial. But I would suggest an additional approach. Reject the premise of population growth itself. Why should we accept the argument that expanding the population is an absolute good? I absolutely agree with this. And I think it's very, very important to question that. Why is it important that there always be more people? It's only important if you have a badly constructed economy and badly constructed political system. Then you're always wanting more people because, well, you need more people paying in, so you can do all the various Ponzi-type schemes that you've built up. That's not a good way to do things. It's not a sustainable way to do things, as people like to say. Population growth is not necessarily a good thing. The only reason why we want to worry about white populations is simply because non-whites are breeding faster than we are. But that even wouldn't be a problem if they didn't have access to our countries, if they were not within our borders, and if they were not enfranchised to vote, and if they were not given access to our roads where they have their drunk driving accidents, access to our social programs that they don't pay into, et cetera, et cetera. If those people weren't here, it wouldn't be so much of an issue. And it's a foolish idea to think that the solution is just have more white babies, as if we want to be in a biological race with Africa to get to a despoiled, standing room only dystopian world. That's not the solution. Population growth in and of itself is not a great thing. And I would go even so far as to say that population shrinkage is not a terrible thing either. Again, Japan's population is aging and it will start shrinking. Now, I love the Japanese. They're my favorite Asian people. They're my favorite non-European people, for that matter. I love their culture. I like them as people. They're interesting. They're wonderfully strange. In some ways, they might as well be from Mars. I love that about them. I love their differences. But their population is going to start shrinking. Is that a tragedy? Well, Japan is a very crowded society. And Japan was a great civilization when it had half the population it has today. There's no reason to think that Japan, if it had control of its borders, maintained control of its borders, didn't have a Ponzi scheme, economy, and welfare state that demands new people to pay in, right? If it doesn't have those factors that are pull factors for immigration and race replacement, then it doesn't even matter if their population shrinks a bit. These are heresies to some people. These are heresies to the just have white babies people. That's not enough. Of course, we have to have white babies. Of course, there has to be a next generation. But we're not going to ever beat the third world in a breeding race. We have to beat them in other ways. We have to exclude them from our living spaces, basically. And if our living spaces are really crowded, and if we've had negative effects from things like birth control and feminism and hedonism and selfishness. And, you know, too many women have decided to be childless bitches because they like Cosmopolitan and Sex in the City and whatever. There is going to be population reduction in a lot of our countries before things level out. We shouldn't think that that is in itself a danger. It's not a good thing if we are being crowded by other peoples within our borders, but in and of itself, it's not a catastrophe. It's only a catastrophe if we don't control our borders and we don't control our culture. And honestly, if we controlled our borders and our culture, a little bit of culling of people who fall for extremely destructive ideologies and lifestyles wouldn't be a bad thing. So anyway, those are some thoughts on that. That's a very good question. I very much appreciate it. Jasper sends another $50. Thank you. Many nationalists say they hope for a speedy resolution to the war in Ukraine. I, too, don't want any more of our most ardent white nationalists to die, but if partisans don't give Russia a fight, there will be little hope of preserving Ukraine at all. Without a protracted resistance, there is little leverage for Ukraine to negotiate for a sovereign state. Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree with that completely. I said this in my debate with E. Michael Jones. I'm of two minds about this stuff. On the one hand, Ukraine is a white nation with a terribly low fertility rate. I think it's almost as low as Russia. Russia and Ukraine have very low white fertility rates. The last thing they need to be doing from a biological point of view is killing one another. And I do mourn the shedding of white blood. A person that I know personally, Sergei Zaikovsky, he translated my White Nationalist Manifesto into Ukrainian. It hasn't been published yet. I don't know if it ever will be now. He was killed in a battle outside of Kiev against the Russians. I think that's terrible. It's a very personal loss to me. But you can't argue that honorable men should not rush to their country's defense and risk their lives. You can't argue that because if your attitude is that there's nothing worse than dying in battle, then basically you're only fit to be a slave and your country will be conquered and that's what you will become. You have to be willing to take up arms in defense of your country and your honor and your future. If you're not willing to do that, other people will just roll in and destroy you. And I want white countries to preserve themselves. I want them to preserve themselves against non-white invaders and also white and off-white invaders. And a lot of the invaders that are coming in with the Russians aren't Russians at all. They might be Russian by nationality, but they're not Russian by ethnicity. I write about this in my latest piece. I just put it up at Countercurrents today. It's a continuation of my first piece on the Russia-Ukraine conflict. My first recent piece, which was my opening statement that I wrote out for the debate with E. Michael Jones. The latest piece, which I put up today, is part of a rebuttal, not just to Jones, who didn't offer that much to rebut, but to other people who are taking the pro-Russia, anti-Ukraine stance. And I talk about how there's this meme that was very popular and it went into normie circles. It was shared by normie commentators. I think it was even shared by Tucker Carlson, where people were contrasting these two recruitment videos, one a Russian one and the other an American one. And the Russian one was of this very macho white guy looking very determined, getting his hair shorn and, you know, training. And he's this big buff dude. Apparently, this guy does gay porn as well as commercials for the Russian military. At least that's one thing that was alleged very plausibly with photographs, I'm afraid, on one of these Ukrainian Telegram channels that I'm following. So anyway, there's this buff, tough-looking white Russian guy, and then it's being contrasted with this thing where it's about some female soldier who has two mommies. And people say, oh, the woke American military can't compete with all these tough Russian white guys. Well, the truth of the matter is, the Russian military isn't all that tough, it's not all that white, and it's not all that Russian, it turns out. They are recruiting a lot of people from Russia itself, the Russian Federation, who are not ethnically Russian. They're recruiting a lot of people from the stans, not outside of Russia, but places like Dagestan and Chechnya, these areas that are Muslim. They're bringing in people from places like Buryatia or something like that, and Tuva, the land of the throat singers, basically Mongol tribal types, highly violent people. These are not your Asiatics that gave us Japanese and Chinese high civilization. These are people who are more equivalent in their lifestyle, alcohol consumption, and senseless violence to American Indians on reservations. These people are flocking to Russia's call. These people are disproportionately represented in Russia's army. And guess what? Diversity breeds weakness there too. So I don't think that we have to worry too much that our woke army is going to be crushed by Russia's homogeneously white, tough, heterosexual army anytime soon, because it's not all that tough. They have the same kind of nauseating diversity propaganda in Russia as we do in America. Putin was giving a speech where he was talking about the soldiers and he was saying, you know, I am a Chechen. I am a, I don't know, a gypsy or whatever. I don't know all the names that he went through. This is the same kind of swill that you get in the United States. But the United States also has recruitment stuff that appeals to macho white guys, just like that Russian ad did. So it's just not an effective, valid comparison. It turns out that their military is weakened by diversity, and that is what you'd expect from an empire with an aggressively multicultural ideology. And that has always played the game. They've done it since the Soviet Union, during the Soviet Union, and under the Tsars, where they would basically take people from one part of their empire and use them to police or conquer other areas of the empire, including the homeland. It's an old policy. It's based on the true assumption that people are more willing to kill people who don't belong to their own ethnic group. The Russian Revolution, the October Revolution, was greatly aided by the fact that the Tsars did this too. They had a bunch of Latvians with rifles in St. Petersburg. Turns out these Latvians with rifles were very useful in storming the Winter Palace when the time came. Anyway, I want to move forward to one more question from Jasper. So Jasper writes with $25, while it turns my stomach to see our most dedicated nationalists killed by Chechens and Kalmyks, and the dog's breakfast of multi-ethnic Russia, what are nationalists for if not to preserve their nation? These men are why war memorials are built. I hope for a quick end of the war, but not if it erases Ukraine from the map. Exactly. It's very, very interesting. I remember the day the war started, people on uns.com, the usual suspects, they're all over the front page, were saying things like, and as if it was a fact, Kiev is going to fall in 2 days. The leaders of Azov have fled to Poland. They've taken Mariupol. Okay, more than a month has gone by, and none of those things have happened. I think that's very, very interesting. They haven't apologized for this. They haven't explained why they were saying things that were completely false. And nor do I expect them to. Propagandists don't tell the truth. They don't own up to their lies and mistakes. They just tell another one. They don't look back. They just tell another one. Okay, so Sunshine's Kid writes in with $3. You've debated Jones. Would you be willing to debate the Ukrainian issue with, for example, Eric Stryker? Oh, I would debate Jones again if it was for a good cause. Stryker, absolutely. He's a terrible debater. I would make absolute mincemeat out of him. I would like to debate somebody who's good at debating on this issue, frankly. But if it was for a good cause, I would definitely debate Stryker. And I guess it's a good cause because I'd like to clean our movement out of these Russia shills who are an embarrassment to us all. They're an embarrassment because they tell lies. They're an embarrassment because they, well, we'll put it this way. And I have a couple questions here that are related to this. So let me just dive into this and I'll make it as quick as I can. So somebody on Gab the other day asked me if I have heard that the recent rant about me, Greg Johnson, on TRS and wished to respond. And my reaction to that was, you know, here's my big reaction. I wrote a shorter reaction, but my full reaction is this. You know, there was a time when I used to really like these people. I used to really respect them. I introduced them to my friends. I promoted them at Countercurrents. I tried to be as helpful as I could. Why? Because I thought they were talented. I thought they were interesting. I thought they were entertaining. I liked Sven a lot. I bristled at the Sven not too much memes because I thought he was actually very, very talented. And I met them in person and I liked them personally. I thought they were warm, real people who were very interesting in conversation. Sven, Mike, other people who were involved. And then it just turned out, that wasn't to last, right? You have lots of warm friendships in high school that don't exist anymore. Why is that? Well, you grow or they grow or both of you grow and you just don't recognize these people anymore. You might have some fond reminiscences, but you just don't feel it anymore. And that's the way I feel about them now. And it's gotten to the point where I'm not even curious to know what they have to say about me anymore. I've just lost all respect and all affection for them. And I don't care. So that's my basic answer. Somebody like Stryker, I've never respected. I think he's contemptible. He can't talk for 5 minutes without lying. He just resorts to lies, not as a last resort, as a first resort. I think he's mentally unstable in some way because he seems like a lot of people that I've encountered in this movement who are basically paranoid and they are fantasists. So because they have this paranoia, this chugging psychological obsession with seeing the worst in everything, and they seem to have no compunction about making up stuff to fit their narratives just on the spot. And it's breathtaking when you see it. And I've seen enough of it to find it repulsive. And I don't think people like this are useful at all because I think telling the truth is the most important thing that we can do. Right now, most of us are just voices on the internet. The only power we have is to be more truthful, more honest about the world as we see it than the mainstream people who have all the power and the money and control our society. They control our society. They have all the money. They've got all the power, but they're telling lies about catastrophic things, and we're telling the truth. And eventually, I hope that we can take that advantage in truth-telling and flip the situation. You start by telling the truth. You start building networks of people. You start building political movements and communities, and eventually, you flip the situation. That's how these things have happened in the past. That's how we need to do it. I don't think having liars and fantasists in the mix really helps. But if it's for a good cause, I would even debate that guy. So that's a good question. Thank you very much. Another guy wrote to me today on Telegram and he said, did I really say that the National Justice Party is a grift? Okay, this might be related to the rant that was reported on or not. My response was basically this. And I think this is important because it's a way that uncritically repeating propaganda can damage your credibility and the credibility of your organizations and your movement. It's a lesson in keeping it honest and not contradicting yourself. What I said is merely this. I said, one of the things coming out of Stryker's mouth and another thing that I've seen Mike Enoch asserting is a made in Moscow talking point that I heard starting in 2014. The Ukraine can't go west. If they become westernized, if they become part of Europe, if they join NATO, they will inevitably be flooded with refugees and destroyed as a nation. It's inevitable. They couldn't stop this. So they have to stay away from the West. Okay, this meme even came out of the mouth of my friend Gregory Hood in a podcast recently about Ukraine and Russia with Chris Roberts. And it's a very damaging thing to say. Why is it a damaging thing to say? Well, if you know anything about Ukraine, they have a very large nationalist movement. They have two nationalist political parties. In the last election, they didn't poll all that strongly, a little over 2% for both of them. So 4-point-something% for Svoboda and for National Core, which arose out of the Azov movement. I think it was in the big election before the last one, Svoboda got about 10%. Their leader was a cabinet member in the post-Yanukovych government. Okay, that might be small potatoes to some of you, but it's infinitely more than has been accomplished in most Western countries, including the United States. If in Ukraine, this vast movement that can mobilize political parties, that has its own army, basically, that has basically a state within a state where Azov and the broader right, the National Core, engage in their own foreign policy. I saw this with my own eyes in 2018. They have their own political, diplomatic, military liaisons with countries like Poland and Lithuania. They're very mature people. They're well-funded. They're well-funded in part because they have so many people who support them that even in a poor country, a white third world country like Ukraine, they can support large political parties and engage in important stuff. They have a very large community. They have their own businesses. They have their youth camps. They have their networks. They take care of one another. It's very impressive. If a country with that kind of nationalist movement is doomed if it enters NATO, doomed if it enters the EU, what does that say about the chances of the National Justice Party in America? If Azov is doomed, then NJP is doomed a hundredfold. That's just the logical implication of what they're saying. If doom is inevitable for these countries because of globo homo, which is a term that I don't like all that much, to be honest, but if doom is inevitable because of globo homo, then what chance do we in the heart of globo homo have to do anything? And that goes for Greg Hood at the platform of American Renaissance. It goes for Mike and Strike and the NJP and so forth. If they're doomed, we're 100 times doomed. Now, why are they saying that they're doomed? It's because they've been uncritically, or maybe not so innocently, passing on Russian talking points. These talking points were made in Moscow. They're Russian talking points designed to appeal to people in our milieu. I started seeing this in 2014, and it's all back. A lot of the same suspects are saying it. Most of them can be found on the front pages of the UNS Review now. So the next part of this argument is basically this. If you believe that our efforts in the United States are doomed, and logically, you have to believe that if you think that much better movements in other countries are doomed. You know, Greg Hood went so far as to say that he thinks that Poland and Hungary are doomed because they're part of the EU. This is before Orban was elected for the fifth time last weekend and expanded his number of seats in the parliament. If they're doomed, then we're 100 times doomed. Well, if you really believe that, then what are you doing? What are we doing? If we believe that we're doomed, what are we doing? And this made me think of a question that I got a few weeks ago, which was, Greg, if you believed it was all hopeless, what would you do? And I said, if I believed it was hopeless, I would quit. Why would I quit? Well, because if I believed it was hopeless and kept taking money from people, I would be a grifter. Basically, that's a good definition of a grifter. It's not a definition of every grifter, but certainly anybody who fits that description is grifting. If somebody in his heart of heart believes that it's hopeless and still wants you to pay your dues and send in your donations, they become a grifter. And they should step aside and allow people who actually believe that victory is possible to have a platform instead. And that's what I would do. If I came to believe that it was hopeless, and believe me, folks, I have been close in the last couple of years. My estimation of the intelligence and maturity of the human race in general, and our movement in particular, has catastrophically collapsed with COVID. I have become much more pessimistic and much more misanthropic since COVID. It's just the truth, right? And then seeing these Walking Dead Russia memes coming back after the Ukraine invasion, that's been very depressing. It's very discouraging to see people behaving in ways that are stupid or dishonorable or both. And it bothers me. It bothers me, and it makes me wonder, can we ever make anything of this? Are there enough serious people to save our nation, save our race in America? However, I believe that it's still possible to win. And therefore, I'm still here. If I came to the conclusion that it's not possible to win, I'd just basically hand the mic over to somebody else and leave. And so I have to ask the people who are pushing this meme, if you really think it's hopeless in Europe, then there's no hope in America. Absolutely no hope in America. We're so far behind what a lot of countries are doing in Europe and America. Same in the UK. We're so far behind what countries in Europe are doing. If they're hopeless, then we're doubly, triply, 100 times hopeless. So we have to be careful what we're saying. We can't say dumb things because we want to own, I don't know who, own the libs on Twitter with the little Ukrainian flags on their accounts by saying things that, if we take them seriously, mean that we've given up, that it's hopeless for us. That's bad propaganda. They think that they're helping out the cause by spreading Russian propaganda, but it's actually doom-pilling, destructive propaganda that undermines the credibility of their own enterprises. Now, if you confront people who do this with this argument, my hope is that they'll stop with the Russian remarks. They'll stop the doom-pilling. They'll drop that particular premise. And if they don't, then I have to ask them, why are you still here? Why are you still doing this? Why are you taking a position that could be occupied by somebody who actually thinks that we can win this? So that's what Max is reacting to. This argument has emerged in the past few weeks, basically, in comments, I guess, that I've made on various social media platforms and in our live streams here. And, you know, the pieces have come together. And yeah, this is a powerful argument. If you don't want to be seen as a grifter, stop saying things that entail that if you remain in the fight, if you have your parties, if you have your podcasts, if you're collecting money, and you don't believe that money is going to actually contribute to the cause, you're a grifter. It looks bad, and you need to address this extremely bad look. The optics are bad. You've got to address this at the very least. So that's my response to Max. Gaddius writes in the chat, Greg's right, I can't go to UNS if I want to read anything not about Russia, Ukraine lately. Ganser Penadier writes, Greg Hood is just blackpilled. He is a good guy. Yeah, I know, but we have to be very, very careful about indulging our feelings about these things. Because if we indulge our feelings too much and say things that commit us to basically giving up hope and dragging other people down, we've got to ask ourselves, are we providing value? Are we adding value, or are we taking it away? Gaddius writes, in the end, we're going to win, folks. I believe that. I really, really believe that. We are going to win. Why? Because truth is on our side. Because our enemies are utterly ridiculous. And if we give them everything they want, they will destroy the world. They will destroy everything good and holy. I don't think the human race, especially the white race, is so depraved that we will let that happen. Norse Nature writes, it's interesting when you see the same opinion by many people all the same time without much discussion. It's probably propaganda. And Hadrian was right, chimes in, yeah, and it happened almost overnight despite a few years of criticizing Putin. Yeah, this is true. Norse Nature, the Russia shilling has been going way too far. I agree. Based Man 2 says the Russians recruit from the poorest areas of the Russian Federation, Asiatic hordes of soldiers. These are also people who are very likely to commit war crimes. I mean, they commit crimes against their own people all the time. Again, the Tuvans behave like American Indians. They drink a lot. They rape one another. They murder one another at astonishing rates. Why wouldn't they behave that way in Ukraine? The Buryats do the same sort of stuff. But of course, war crimes have been a Soviet tool of war. Ilya Ehrenberg was urging these people on to rape their way across Germany, and they did. This hasn't gone away just because communism is gone. Communism took up a lot of the techniques of imperial statecraft that were perfected by the czars and just made them even more horrible. And a lot of those communist techniques are still around under Putin, because Putin and practically everybody around him were brought up under communism. They were alumni of the communist state. Putin was a KGB officer, one of the most horrible, evil organizations in human history. He was brought up by them. They use all the same techniques of statecraft. So we shouldn't be too surprised by that. Baseman says only 31% of the population of Moscow are ethnic Russians in 2022. That's astonishing if true. Big if true. Yeah. The people in the West who think that Russia is what the liberal media says it is are making the same mistake as the people who think that Trump is what the liberal media says it is. Trump was a civic nationalist, right? And what is civic nationalism? Well, right-wing civic nationalism is kind of a conservative, patriotic form of lying by saying, you know, we're all Americans. It doesn't matter what our race or religion is. It's all, we're all Americans. We have to lie about all the differences that make that not happen. Well, if you want to have a really authoritarian, right-wing based conservative civic nationalism, you have Putin. What does Putin do? If you point out problems with multiculturalism, you get thrown in prison. It's much harder for ethnic Russians to criticize multiculturalism, which is stacked against them in Russia, than it is for us to criticize multiculturalism, which is stacked against us in the West. This means that the people who argue that Russia is better for the white race than the West are wrong. What's good for the white race is we get out from under multiculturalism, we get out from under multicultural regimes, and we regain control of our own destiny. They can't do that in Russia. Why? Because multiculturalism has teeth. We can do it in the West because multiculturalism doesn't have the same amount of repressive force behind it yet. And we better use our freedom of speech while we still got it. There's some urgency here. The window is not going to remain open forever, but there is the possibility of rectifying things in the West. There's no possibility for dissidents to rectify things in Russia, which is why so many Russian ethno-nationalists fled to Ukraine and are now fighting, who have taken up arms against Russia because they saw no future for what they were doing in Russia under Putin's basically authoritarian multiculturalist regime. And then you have people like this Gonzalo Lira guy, who's a Putin cheerleader. He basically just repeats ridiculous talking points. I think he's still saying that they're trying to avoid civilian casualties, for instance. Nobody who bombs cities into smithereens like the Russians have done is trying to avoid civilian casualties. What they're saying is that they're trying to avoid civilian casualties. And unfortunately, all these civilians are dying because the Ukrainians are using them as human shields. They're only really trying to shoot at the soldiers. They just have to shoot through all those civilians to get to the soldiers. But that's the soldiers' fault. It's the soldiers' fault because if they just surrender, none of this bad stuff would have to happen. That's the argument. But this Lira guy, this guy would basically make America over in Putin's image. He was talking about how racism should be illegal and crushed in America. Basically, people like us would have to go to jail. Why? Because, well, he's not a white guy or a sort of an off-white guy, but he's a civic nationalist, right? He wants civic nationalism with teeth. He wants a conservative red, white, and blue patriotic form of lying about race rather than the degenerate left-wing lying about race. It's still bad. It's still bad. And if we're going to rectify things every day, we should put our hands together and thank the founding fathers for the First Amendment. We should thank liberals who are still actually liberal enough to believe in freedom of speech. These are the things that are saving us. The kind of stuff that these trad Vlad lovers would sweep away in a second because, well, authoritarianism is based in red pill in their views. Authoritarianism plus multiculturalism is basically death to our race. And that's what Russia is. Now, you can say, well, wait a second. Russia's still about 80% ethnically Russian and maybe another 8% or so ethnically other things that are white. Maybe it's only 10%, 11% non-white. And a lot of these people, of course, who are ethnically white but not Russian are Muslims, which are another problem altogether. By some calculations, Muslims are 15% of the population of the Russian Federation. I've seen estimations that they're 30 to 40% of the military. I don't know what to do with these numbers. There's this Grand Mufti of Russia who's claiming that Muslims are 25% of the Russian Federation. I don't care how white they are. If they're Muslim, they belong to an inimical civilization that can only destroy white civilization. So just putting it in black and white or white and non-white terms is somewhat skewed when the Muslims come into the picture. Anyway, the fact remains that even if Russians are 80% of the Russian Federation, they have lower fertility rates than people like the Tuvans. The Tuvans reproduce twice as much as the Russians, more than twice as much as last I looked. That means that even without immigration from outside of Russia, that race replacement is baked in to the Russian Federation as it exists, and the government there will throw you in jail for talking about it. In the long term, that spells death to Russia. In 1965, America was 90% white. Today, we're lucky to be 60%. Now, if we had no non-white immigration, we might still be 80% white, but we would still be declining because of the differential fertility rates of indigenous non-white groups. It's the same problem in Russia. And they also have immigration from the former Soviet stans, these places in Central Asia that are filled with non-whites and people of mixed race, Mongoloid peoples, sort of Caucasoid peoples from the South, people who are more Middle Eastern than European. A lot of those people are in Russia, legally or illegally, they're in Russia, and they're ethnically displacing the native Russians. So the situation there in the long term is bad. And as long as Putin's in power, they're going to crush people who try and speak about it, like I'm speaking about it, under the umbrella of the First Amendment in the United States. So this is stuff to take into account. The people who think that Putin is going to save us are just delusional. He's not going to save us. He's just another version of the same imperialist, ethnocidal, multicultural policies that reign in the West, without the freedom of speech and therefore without the possibility of turning things around. Sad but true. He's not going to save us. We've got to save ourselves. Fortunately, we've got truth on our side, and we've got the First Amendment on our side. We don't have time on our side, but it's not so urgent that we have to behave stupidly. We have some decades to turn this all around. And the sooner we get over the idea that there's some guy who's going to defeat Globo Homo and give a black eye to America and do our work for us, the better, right? A lot of this is very passive, waiting for the man on the white horse to come save us, thinking. It's not a way to win. It's just a way to basically reduce white identity politics into sports fandom. It's a game. It's an online game for people. We're looking at what's happening, and we're cheering a guy that we imagine is on our side. I remember when white nationalists were really, really excited when they imagined that Ron Paul is sort of on our side. Or even, God forbid, it's true. I remember when there were people who had convinced themselves that Mitt Romney would actually be good for white interests. And they would feel elated if Romney was doing well. It's all delusional. It's the same kind of delusional thinking that caused people to go full Q-tard. What did the Q narrative teach people? It taught them that there was a powerful group of people in the U.S. government, in the military, where we all imagine the deep state really is, right? A powerful group of people who believed what we believe and were about to unleash the storm and give us what we all wanted. It was just delusional. It's delusional thinking. The Q-tard delusions are the pattern for the Z-tard delusions that we're dealing with. So I think that we've just got to give up on delusional fantasy thinking, and we've got to take stock of what we have available to us, namely the truth. We've also got the First Amendment available to us in the United States, which we need to use or we'll lose. And I think that based on truth and the freedom to speak it and the credibility that comes from speaking it, we can build a community, build a movement, and switch things around so that we win in the end. There are a couple other little questions I want to answer. Here's one of those, what's your favorite color questions? Eric writes in and asks me if I have any favorite post-apocalyptic movies. There are two that I really like. One is it 12 Monkeys? I'm blanking out the title. I think it's 12 Monkeys. Yeah, I thought that was an excellent movie. Terry Gilliam directed it. It had Bruce Willis in it. I thought it was quite good, quite imaginative, just cinematically beautiful, very imaginative, very, very interesting, had some interesting twists to it. I like that a lot. I kind of like the Mad Max movies too. Well, beyond Thunderdome, no, but The Road Warrior, the Mad Max film, and then the reboot of it with Tom Hardy, I thought those were all entertaining films. they have definitely some value to them. So those are a couple of post-apocalyptic films. I wonder if you folks out there have your suggestions. I'm sure I'm missing out on a few excellent ideas, frankly. So yeah, I got that question. And he also asks, Eric asks, how would I like to die? Maybe that's a great way of ending the show. Well, put it this way. I would like to die having lived a very full life. And I've always been haunted by the knowledge that I could die any day. This could be my last podcast. If it's going to be your last podcast, make it a good one. If it could be your last day, make it a good day. So I guess the way that I want to put it is that however I die, I want to have lived without evading the fact that I am going to die eventually, that I could die anytime, and that death isn't something out there in the future waiting for me. And in the meantime, I'm immortal, right? I'm mortal, which means we can go anytime, which means we have to make the most of what time we have right now. You can't just eat, drink, and be merry and not think about the future. And that's actually not a very good way of living. I mean, hedonism, you know, it's not a good way of living. The one thing that Ludwig Wittgenstein reportedly said that I thought was profound, and I can't find the source of this, but I've seen it. He said, I don't know what the purpose of life is, but I'm pretty sure it's not to have a good time. I love that. It's not an argument. It's just a candid saying. I don't know what the purpose of life is, but I'm pretty sure it's not to have a good time. And the people who just think it's short-term pleasure in the moment, well, that's a very, very shallow thing. And you get bored with it. I get bored with it really fast. And so I want to do things that are significant. And that's why I'm doing what I'm doing right now. I think this is a significant life. I think that if I died tomorrow, I could say I was happy. I think I could say it's well lived. And how I would like to go, well, if, you know, I don't want to die in agony or something like that. I don't want to die after a long period of, say, cancer or just ill health where bits and pieces of my body are being cut off or of senility after a long, you know, period of senility. I think that's just disgusting. I hope that I live very, you know, vigorously and healthily. My family tend to be long-lived unless they have accidents. And we're not especially accident-prone. But I have relatives who have lived comfortably and vigorously into their 90s. And if I can do that without basically becoming gaga or whatever, I'd be happy with that. And if I can't do that, I hope that I'll die before life just becomes a burden to me and other people. But the key thing is to always try and make what you're doing now significant because you could go at any time. So folks, that's all I want to do for today. I really want to thank the moderators. You've been great. I want to thank our donors, especially Jasper. Thank you very much. Gaddius, thank you very much. I want to thank all of you listening who make this possible. And we're going to return next week with another episode of Counterpoise Radio.